Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is Aaron Weinacht, and I'm here with the Russian and Eurasian Studies section of the New Books Network. And today we're talking to one of my grad school mentors, Dan Rowland, who's got a new book, kind of an unusual book, on the political culture of early modern Russia. It's called God, Tsar, and People. So thanks for taking the time to talk to me about it, Dan.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Believe me.
I mentioned here that this is kind of an unusual book, and so I was wondering if you could just start off by describing what kind of book is this?
Well, maybe, Aaron, what you meant by, first of all, let me tell you how fond my memories are of you as a graduate student. Your work on Ayn Rand is really quite sensational, and I hope it gets the attention that it deserves. Ayn Rand is really a pivotal figure in the American right, and I think your work on her has been really important. Anyway, the reason I think that the book is a little unusual, it's a collection of essays that I've written over a period of almost 50 years. The very first essay is an unpublished essay that I wrote in graduate school before some major redating of documents, which we can come to maybe later. And I had it in my drawer until this book came out, and I took it out, and I left it almost exactly the way it was. And the final essay I wrote a year ago this last summer in preparation for the publication of the book. So that really spans my whole academic career. These essays just deal with different topics in the really what you might call the history of political thought in early modern Russia. It covers the period more or less 1450 to 1700, but really concentrates on the 16th and early 17th century, that is to say, maybe 1500 to 1650. What I'm trying to do in the book is to figure out from the evidence that we have, which is a little bit different than the kind of evidence that exists for such a period in Western Europe, from the evidence that we have, writings and particularly images, I'm trying to figure out how the Russians imagined their own political structure. What did they think about the Tsar? What did they think about the obligations and rights, if they ever would use that word, which they didn't, of his subjects, and so on. So I wanted to kind of capture the imagination of early modern Russians as it relates to what we would call politics.
Oh, thanks for the summary there, Dan. I was wondering, maybe before you get farther into the book, if you'd mind telling everybody, since the book starts back at the beginning of your academic career, how'd you get into studying Russian history to begin with? You actually talk about that a little bit in the introduction, as I recall.
I do. It's a very strange tale and a somewhat abbreviated version is that I really got into Russian history through music. I was singing in 1963, in the summer of 63, with the Yale Glee Club, We sang in Belgrade and went to a reception at the home of the home of the ambassador, who was George Kennan. And so we got into a conversation with George Kennan. But more importantly, there was a folk dancing group at this reception from Serbia. And I just love the music. I love Serbian music. I love Macedonian music. I'd never heard it really before. And of course, this folk orchestra struck up a Serbian dance, and a beautiful Serbian woman took me by the hand and asked me if I'd like to dance in a long line. And of course, I have no idea how to dance, but I really wanted to learn. And so fast forward, I was on a scholarship, a Marshall scholarship to England, and I immediately found a Balkan folk dancing group and joined it. And that almost everybody in the folk dancing group, or at least many people, were in the choir of a very small Orthodox church there in Oxford, England. And so I began to sing in the choir and became very interested in Russian affairs. And that's how I got interested in Russia.
Yeah, we all have these little winding journeys. You know, I think mine happened because I happened to cross Crime and Punishment on my dad's bookshelf when I was like 12, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's amazing actually how much coincidence happens. But, you know, as it relates to the book, because of that kind of introduction and that you have Crime and Punishment as a gateway, I think it's really interesting looking at your work. But I think that I had music as a gateway, which is really part of culture. I'm really a cultural historian. I think is a kind of my, the kind of creed of my craft is that I try to foreground the role that culture plays in causing political events. So I'm in that way, and maybe only in that way, a kind of anti-Marxist. I really look to culture. And so all of this, my book is all about political culture and ways that it may have affected people's behavior and not the other way around.
So kind of moving into the meat of the book then, you've emphasized in a number of ways, like not trying to, trying not to evaluate Muscovite history with categories that don't seem to apply very well. You know, like I was thinking in particular, you've got a section in there where you're essentially saying that the question, why didn't the boyars revolt if Ivan was so bad, is a bad question to ask, right? So could you talk a bit about, you know, what it means to speak the language that people in that political culture are speaking rather than one that's imported from outside?
Yeah. Actually, Aaron, thank you. That's really a good and very important question. When I began my work as a graduate student, it seemed to me that the categories that historians, 20th century historians, were asking were in some ways misleading. And the misleading questions led, I thought, to a misreading, from misleading to misreading, of evidence. And so what I tried to do, and I'm sure that I didn't succeed completely and that other people will do a better job, but I tried to just go to the sources and listen as carefully as I could to what they said. As I argue in a number of the pieces in the book, there's a kind of subtext in all of these sources, which is A, the Bible, and B, even more important, liturgical texts that use biblical texts, because the liturgical text would have been more familiar to Muscovite audience than probably a biblical text. And so I tried to tune my antennae into hearing these quotations. And then I tried to understand the language of political discourse in its own terms, rather than trying to impose 20th century questions. Let me just qualify to say that it's perfectly legitimate and important that 20th century historians and now 21st century historians ask our own questions. So I think it's important to know or to ask the question, was, let's say, 16th century Russia or 17th century Russia, was it basically a kind of dictatorship? And did it lay the ground for what Vladimir Putin is now doing in Russia now? And that's a perfectly legitimate question. But I think that before you can answer it, you need to kind of go back to the sources and see the language that they employ to describe their thought. And then once you understand that in as much a full dimension as you can, then you apply your findings to answer questions that 20th century historians or 21st century historians want to know. So it's a kind of two-stage listening process. And without very careful attending to the meaning of the sources, it's very easy to come up with oversimplified answers using not really 19th and 20th century historians' categories that don't really belong. One example of that, and there's lots of others, is our idea of politics. This is something that I've kind of worried to death in my work, but we imagine politics in a 19th century context, which has come back over into the 20th century and into our own time in 21st century America. And politics for us is a kind of game where political actors get together because they agree on a series of policy positions, and that on the basis of that agreement, they agree to act together, and that is what constitutes politics: people acting together in pursuit of a group of policies. In Russia, it's really, especially before Peter, but really way after Peter too, that kind of politics didn't really exist. And so, especially if you look at Soviet scholarship up through the 90s, really up through the 80s, they're talking about a boyar party and a party of new men and so on, as if these are like 19th or 20th century political parties. Other scholars have looked at this, and I've looked at it from an ideological point of view, and there's very, very little evidence that people came together to act to implement agreed-on policies. They basically didn't have the kind of politics that we think of, and therefore, using the word politics is just already brings in a whole set of ideas in our brains that weren't there in the brains of early modern Russians.
So that said, then, look at it from the other direction and say, how, if we can use the word politics, what was in their minds when they used such a word? If not, thinking of parties now, for instance.
Well, I don't think I've come up with a good answer to that, to be truthful. I mean, in the whole book, but what I've tried to do in a series of essays is to look at various pieces of evidence that gives us good clues. And so they're thinking, I think that God chose the Tsar, and that they should obey the Tsar because God chose him. And that's a very well-known a trope, common and essentially ubiquitous in all the sources. But what's less well-known is that the political culture of early modern Russia gave the people that were thinking about the Tsar criteria by which they could judge the qualities of the ruler. And they could decide whether he was a good or bad ruler. And if they decided he was a bad enough ruler, then he would slide over from kind of God-appointed and therefore, all-powerful to God-opposing. And that sort of meant that he was a forerunner of Antichrist. The Russians were preoccupied by eschatology and by the coming of the end days. And so either he was a forerunner of Antichrist, or he might even be Antichrist himself. But in that case, you have to withdraw. It's not that you have the right to withdraw, but you have the obligation to withdraw your allegiance from him. And so you have these two poles. And there's a middle pole I'll come to in just a moment. On the one, at the end of one pole is an all-powerful ruler who represents whose will or whose dictates represent God's will and who must be obeyed. And at the other pole is essentially the end of history, where the God-appointed ruler of Russia has disappeared and his place has been taken by an imposter. And that means that the end of the world is coming and head for the hills. There's no really conclusion of what happens. It's a very costly, conclusion to come to. But in between those two poles was, I think, where political life really occurred, which is that the Russians believed, and there's lots and lots of evidence of all kinds about this, that a wise ruler and a just ruler rules with advice. And the advice should ideally come from godly men. And therefore, if you make a diagram, and in the book I made a diagram. My wife, who's an illustrator, actually made a diagram for me. It's in an essay of a very, very important early 17th century writer called Ivan Timofeyev. But if she's... Yeah. Hey, Wen, I'm on this interview. You could imagine the will of God coming down like a lightning bolt into the head of the Tsar. But then, if that's interrupted for some reason, it's the role of wise advisors to reconnect the Tsar to God's will. And so the most important qualification of the wise advisors is that they be godly. But it also, the Russians also believed that that there's this important social order and that social order ought to be kept. And so therefore they imagined that the most senior people in the social order, boyars, senior military men, senior clerics, would be the people to give that kind of advice.
So on the problem of advice, like what is it that inherently makes advice a problem? I mean, I guess from my point of view, it looks like it's that, well, if the Tsar is in theory all powerful, then what kind of advice could they need?
Well, yeah, this is what's been really hard to communicate, I think. And it's hard for the sources to communicate it to me, and then it's been hard for me to communicate it elsewhere. But I think that the error has been by modern historians to equate the idea of advice, as I've just explained it, with a kind of parliamentary structure. And so a lot of late 19th and very early 20th century Russian historians imagined that these writers were sort of proto-parliamentarians, and they had a kind of constitutional idea of advice that the Boyar Duma, or the so-called Assembly of the Land, a kind of shady and not often called group of people with representatives from all the towns, that those two organs were sort of proto-parliamentary or parliamentary, and that they would then in time grow into a kind of parliamentary democracy. And many of these historians were, in the late 19th century, hoping for a parliamentary democracy in Russia. And it makes every sense that they were thinking about these things in that way. But I think my critique of their view is that really these categories were not parliamentary or constitutional. They were purely moral. That the ability to give advice depends on the moral quality of the advisor. In the same way that the ability of the Tsar to reflect, or the Tsar's will to reflect God's will, depends on the moral quality of the Tsar. So these moral categories, which really don't have any political meaning in our sense of the word, of a political party or a constitutional philosophy, these moral categories were very important and were very important in lots of other polities, particularly early medieval Europe. So basically, Russia's trying to work out an idea of politics using these moral categories, which just cannot be easily translated into modern political terms.
If that's true, what do you think accounts overall for the desire of any number of historians to find what ultimately isn't there? I mean, is it simply, is it wishful thinking? Is it some kind of late 19th century Whig impulse?
That's a great question. I don't have a really good answer to it, but maybe just another personal story that I was listening to when I was studying in Oxford. I did an undergraduate degree in modern history, and I decided I would take a, you can choose which papers you're going to take. And I took a paper in early modern Russian history. And I'm quite sure I was one of a very, very, very small number of people to take that paper, which is the reason for my choosing it. And I, in order to prepare it for it, I went to a series of lectures by a very famous Oxford professor, Dmitry Obolensky. Now, I don't think he's still alive, actually, but Sir Dmitry Obolensky, who was a Byzantinist, but felt quite entitled to give a series of lectures every other year on early modern Russia. And what he said in those lectures, he was a very good lecturer and very compelling, but what he said about Russia in those lectures, for me, bore an uncanny resemblance to what British historians were saying about England right around the beginning of the 20th century, right around, let's say, 1900. And indeed, as I looked into it further, Kluchevsky and a number of other really important Russian historians were reading English history and getting many of their ideas. I don't know they got their ideas, but certainly they were, it looked like they were getting ideas from early 20th century British historians, like A.J. Pollard or someone like that, and then bringing them over to Russia. So you have a political landscape that's really framed in the same way that early English historians, that is to say early 20th century historians, were framing English history, where you have a monarchy trying to repress the nobility, a group of new men that the monarch chose to ally himself with to oppose the power of the aristocracy. So you have an aristocratic party and you have a new men party or a monarchical party. All of this furniture was sort of adopted, I think pretty literally by Russian historians and then pasted into Russia. And as I was learning in Oxford, those views have long since been discarded, and as they relate to England. But if they were inappropriate for England, they were even less appropriate for Muscovy. So I think your question is a revealing one, and I would like sometime to do more work. I'm 81 years old. Whether I get to do it or not, I don't know. But I think that there's a really nice book or series of articles to be written about the influence of English historiography, that is to say English history writing, on Russian history writing in the period just leading up to the revolution. And then to finish this somewhat bizarre story, clearly with the revolution, they wanted to, the new Bolshevik government wanted to throw out these bourgeois ideas. But then, because Stalin didn't like some of the chief Marxist historians, he brought back the Kluchevsky students and sort of ushered back in these old pre-revolutionary views of what was happening in Russia. And not only did he do that, but he made it politically impossible to oppose those views. So you have a really strange historiographical situation, which I think is really fascinating, but is also, possibly problematic.
Well, it reminds me a bit of the Russian socialist habit in the mid-19th century of reading Hochstausen instead of looking out their back doors at the peasant commune. It's a very similar kind of dynamic there.
Yeah, that's a great parallel, and I think that's it. And I think that, historians, like other people, really are prone to think about, the questions that they ask in connection with their own lived experience. And one of the things that has really intrigued me is that historians of my generation have really been intrigued and really concentrated, and certainly I have, on the question of, was Russia in the 16th and 17th century an absolute ruler? Absolute, again, is a somewhat problematic word, but I think what people meant is a kind of dictatorial arrangement in which the Tsar was all powerful and no power resided at all in either the people or the aristocracy or the army or anywhere else or the church. And I've tried to question that. So that's a kind of, I think that's a question that I thought was important because of my own life experiences. But the younger generation coming up, now isn't particularly interested in that question. Maybe because of the war in Ukraine, they'll get more interested in it again and Putin, but they're really doing other things. And so I think it's inevitable that historians ask questions that they, that their life experience lead them to want to ask. And it just keeps the field alive that the next generation asks other questions, which is wonderful.
So, I was wondering then, since you bring up the question of Russia being some kind of dictatorial state, like this is actually a pretty big debate, or at least it has been in the past. You think you could kind of sketch out for listeners the kind of broad contours of that debate?
Yes, I can quickly. It's now really kind of an old debate. It hasn't, no one's contributed to it much. My essays in the book deal with that, I think, a lot, but not many people are really publishing directly on that. But basically, there were two schools of thought. One held that really the Tsar held almost complete power, and very little power was left to the nobles, who were regarded themselves as his slaves, and even less power was left to the peasants, who basically lived solitary and ignorant lives. I think that view had its roots really in the scholarship of Richard Pipes of Harvard, who published a famous book called Russia Under the Old Regime. But maybe it's not a good idea to name all the adherents of that view, but there was considerable polemical exchange on that subject with their two really important historians who represented that point of view. I would say a lot of the other major scholars in the field, at least in the West, and this has really been a Western controversy. I don't think Russian scholars have really got involved in it. I think there's pretty good reasons for that. But anyway, it's a Western controversy. And I think most of the people have said that this view is just oversimplified. And I think I'm probably out on one end of the field in saying that Russians really believed that the Tsar had responsibilities and that people were aware of those responsibilities. And if he misbehaved, there could be serious consequences. So this is, I suppose, an anti-dictatorial view. My colleagues, and I deal with this in the final essay in the book, my colleagues have coming at this from lots and lots of different points of view, have shown also that there were many other sources of political power in Russia beyond the unitary wish of the monarch. I think what they've decided is that basically, and this is Ned Keenan's position, I think he's maybe the inspirer of much of this, and certainly he's an inspirer of mine. But he argued in a couple of essays that Russia, by European standards or by even world standards, was a very weak political, had a very weak political structure. It didn't have a lot of money. The state didn't have a lot of money. It had a rudimentary bureaucracy for much of the time. And it simply lacked the ability to enforce its will on all these citizens. So this idea of a kind of, you might even say, proto-Stalinist or proto-fascist kind of 16th century regime just doesn't make sense if you look at the simply at the forces at the disposal of the Muscovite state. It just didn't have the power to do that, and I think that's true really all the way up to the time of Peter the Great, and even to some extent under Peter. So let's just take an example of the law. Nancy Coleman has a wonderful new book. Well, it's not new now, but she looked at the way the law actually worked in Russia by looking at case after case after case. And I don't want to misrepresent her, but I think she may have looked at all the surviving cases before the time of Peter the Great. And most of them are in the 17th century. But the point is that the Tsar, he wanted the law to work. The Tsar did, the imperial regime or the Tsarist regime wanted the law to work. And in order for it to work, they had to enlist local helpers because much law was local law involving land disputes or insult disputes or whatever. And so the Tsar had to incorporate the help of a lot of local grandees, but in some cases even peasants, to help execute the law. And one of the things that Nancy discovered is that you didn't want to be handing down a legal judgment unless you took the advice of people around you. You needed to have a proper legal procedure. You couldn't just arrest someone and execute them or throw them in prison. You need to have proper procedure, and that proper procedure required local help. And Nancy and I have both noticed that whenever the Tsar is issuing important decisions in a chronicle or in illustrated chronicle or in other visual sources, he's always surrounded by advisors. So that's really where this idea of advisors come in. They legitimize a decision. And in the cases where the Tsar did not follow legal procedure, it's clear the chroniclers condemned those decisions as lawless and bad.
So what might be some other examples then of like points in society that provide checks on the power of the Tsar? I mean, where does the church fit into this equation, for instance, or stories about bad kings who didn't listen? Or
yeah, well, but before answering that question directly, I think there's been a kind of rearranging of the mental furniture of historians, Russian historians overall, in the way they think about Russian history. Because I think that particularly, non-historian laymen, when they think of Russian history, they think of Stalin, Peter the Great, and Ivan the Terrible. And they're the kind of iconic rulers, and their style of rule, which was very, very heavy-handed for sure. And I think in the case of Stalin, to say heavy-handed is a pretty radical understatement. That those rulers were iconic and really represented typical Russian political structures. And I think what scholars have done throughout Russian, on the writing about the whole reign of Russian history, the whole long period of Russian history, is to see those people as exceptions. And that, in fact, Russian rulers succeeded when they were able to come to an agreement with particularly their elites, and on the basis of that agreement to govern the country. So, I think this is really Ned Keenan's big perception, was that the ruler by himself was really much weaker, both economically, geographically, perhaps, though this is a little more questionable, even militarily. Had the great boyars wanted to move against a ruler, they might have been able to do so. Of course, they did not. So that's another question. But anyway, the rulers, the elite together, were more powerful than the Tsar by himself. And Keenan used to like to use the metaphor of a planet circling the sun, or even more, protons surrounding an atom, in which there's more atomic mass in the surroundings than in the center. And that basically Russia succeeded as a political entity when the elite and the rulers were able to agree on what to do. And their description of the political system, Keenan's description in particular, and I've completely persuaded by this, is that Russia succeeded when the elite and the ruler agreed and ruled together. And when they didn't agree, then things could really fall apart. And there were, Aaron, as you know, and your listeners probably know as well, there were periods of civil war in the Muscovite period. There was civil wars in the 15th century, the so-called Time of Troubles at the end of the 16th and the beginning of the 17th century, where things really did fall apart. And in a situation where that agreement between the elite and the ruler fell apart, then you really had some very painful and economically disastrous, dangerous times when people got killed and the state got much weaker, foreign neighbors invaded. All these things happened that were highly undesirable. So there was a tremendous argument in favor of the elite agreeing. And I think that a lot of people, I'll mention Russ Martin here, a very close colleague who wrote an introduction to my book. But I mean, he's gone to great lengths to show how the political mechanisms of the court in Muscovite Russia were arranged to prevent conflict between the ruler and the elite, and to prevent conflict among groups of elite members. And this meant, again, that they didn't have that kind of 19th century idea of politics that we were talking about a minute ago. There was a huge common interest in agreeing and then presenting a united front to outsiders, particularly foreign outsiders. I think that really deals with the elite. The church is more complicated. And again, the standard view of the church is that it was simply the handmaid of the ruler, and in some cases that it was. Ivan the Terrible certainly was able to arrest and execute the heads of the church. But a century later, you have a patriarch Nikon, who asserted the superiority of the church over the state, and so the church was trying to, in a sense, mind its own business. They were trying to get some kind of control over the parish clergy, which essentially barely existed in the 16th century. In the 17th century, the church is trying to increase discipline. Paul Bushkovich has written a lot about this. But the church, again, did not see its role in the way that the papacy did as a counterpoise to the government. It saw its role as helping to promote this necessary agreement upon which really the prosperity and the success of the realm depended. So, and I think this goes back to the different histories of the papacy and of the Russian Orthodox Church, and particularly Aristotelian political thought, which gave papal apologists and also royal apologists lots of political tools, lots of intellectual tools to fight ideological battles. And then you have an independent papacy in Rome, not under the control of any particular ruler. The environment is completely different in Muscovy, and so the outcome is really different. So I would not say at all that the church was powerless, quite on the contrary, but it did not choose, I think for pretty good reasons, to try to assert itself against a ruler. And I think maybe the greatest example of a ruler who did, of a church leader who did do that, was Metropolitan Philippe, who did his best to upbraid Ivan for his immoral actions and was eventually arrested and finally murdered in a cell.
So maybe wrapping up this particular theme then, the right answer to Richard Hilly's question about why the Muscovite elite didn't rebel is that they correctly perceived that it was not in their best interest to do that.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. Well, again, I think from a practical point of view, it was not in their interest to do that. And then you also had an ideology that made it very, you know, a political culture that made it costly to do that. Because if you finally decided that the Tsar had to be resisted, you know, in a forceful way, not by wise advisors, but resisted militarily, then you get into thinking that the Tsar was the Antichrist, and the whole political, there was no, it's the same situation with Putin now, there was really no mechanism for selecting another Tsar. And so replacing the Tsar was a very costly step.
A bit like the problem in China of what do you do when there's a bad emperor?
Yes. This was a problem, Aaron, you know, of all early modern and medieval political systems. What do you do with a bad king, as Ned used to say, Ned Keenan? And it was it just bugged everybody until there was a parliamentary alternative. And then it became, if not moot, at least less pressing.
Speaking of rulers who at least have a bad reputation, you've got an interesting section in the book on some architectural business under Boris Godunov. I was wondering if you could talk about that, particularly since for lots of listeners, probably their total exposure to Boris Godunov as a result of watching Rocky and Bullwinkle. wonder if you could talk a bit about the Boris Godunov's architectural project.
Well, there's a paper I've just been just finished last week makes a point that Russian culture believed in typology, and this is a somewhat roundabout answer to your question, but basically, they believed that a Russian ruler could be a type of an Old Testament ruler. And so going back to Yaroslav the Wise, who's important both for Russia and for Ukraine, obviously, who was the grand prince in Kiev. Yaroslav was a younger son, but he was, and he overthrew his older brother in a civil war. He was regarded as the second Solomon because he built Hagia Sophia, Holy Wisdom, the Church of Holy Wisdom, in Kyiv. And for building that, he was called Yaroslav the Wise. I think Boris Godunov wanted to be called Boris the Wise because he had very ambitious architectural plans for rebuilding essentially the whole complex in the Kremlin. Had he succeeded, and had he founded a dynasty the way the Romanovs did a few years later, I think he'd be remembered probably as maybe Boris the Wise or Boris the Wannabe Wise. But Boris was, I think, a really interesting person. Historians are really divided. A lot of my friends who know the most about him really think he was a tyrant or a very brutal ruler, and he was. I see him as a much more modern ruler. He was very interested in the West, sent ambassadors to find out what was going on. He made a speech at his coronation. He took off his shirt and said that he'd take off his shirt and give it to the poorest of the poor in order to help them. And he dealt, there were some very serious famines caused by cyclical weather patterns in Northern Europe, and people were starving. And he did a really good job, I think, in making the royal granaries available to the common people and dealing. I mean, he's a little bit like Trump and Biden trying to deal with a pandemic. He was dealt, I think, amazingly effectively with a very surprise sort of bad situation that occurred because of the weather. But Boris Godunov was not from the royal ruling family, which had ruled Russia since Kievan times. He was, in that sense, an upstart. And some of his descendants came from the Mongols or from the Genghisids, and not really from Slavic descendants. And of course, the original Rurikais were Scandinavians, which complicates the problem even more. But nonetheless, they weren't from the traditional ruling clan. He wasn't from the traditional ruling clan. And so he was regarded to some extent as a usurper. And he was very interesting to me because he had to create legitimacy for himself that did not depend on his being the eldest son of the reigning czar, which had been the pattern really from about 1500 on. And so he had to create legitimacy, which he did by demonstrating his piety, showing his military capability and success, and so on. So he's a really fascinating person. But his luck ran out. There was a person, the Poles were very anxious to remove him because I think they realized he was a much more capable ruler than Ivan had been or that any of the interim rulers had been. And so the Poles encouraged a pretender and a civil war ensued, and Boris died as a result of that civil war. So he didn't succeed. Under other circumstances, it seems to me, this is counterfactual history, but under other circumstances, it seems he might well have established a dynasty. He had a son and a daughter. They were both healthy and apparently, admirable people, if one can say that. Had there not been a civil war, had there not been this whole issue of legitimacy, which is a political cultural question for sure, then he might have established the dynasty. But again, this shows the importance of culture because the Russian political culture simply did not have a method for choosing a ruler who was not the God-chosen ruler in their imagination. And the God-chosen ruler was the eldest son of the former ruler. And so long as that pattern existed, it really held. Without it, then things really fell apart. And those civil wars, I think, really illustrate the pain that occurs when disagreements among the elite and between the elite and the ruler break out.
One more kind of big question here about some material you covered in the book specifically. You do this kind of big think piece towards the end of the book, the Ivan as the Carolingian Renaissance Prince piece. And I was wondering if you could talk about that for a bit. What's the benefit then if Ivan is kind of a problem no matter what point of view you come at him from? And I certainly got a lot out of the interview I did with Charles Halperin over that book of his on Ivan the Fourth here in the last, no, was that a couple of years ago? I think that came out now. So what's the benefit of looking at Ivan the Fourth through the lens of the Carolingian Renaissance? What do we gain by looking at him that way?
Well, I think what we gain, and what gave me a lot of pleasure in writing that, was that that was a reply to a pretty famous and influential essay by Charles Halperin's thesis advisor, Michael Chernyavsky. And the title of Michael Chernyavsky's essay was Ivan the Terrible as a Renaissance Prince. And what Chernyavsky was trying to do in that essay was to say that in many ways, Ivan's court was quite close to the court of a Renaissance prince, a Medici or whatever, and that political thinking at his time was comparable, and that it was that basically Russia was much closer to contemporary Europe than it was than I think it really was, and so in the essay, I said, that really, if you're trying to find a parallel in Western Europe to the Russia of Ivan the Terrible, the best parallel is to Carolingian Europe. And my strong suit, because this is what I work with, is the suit of political thought. And if you look at political thought in Western Europe, with Machiavelli and Hobbes and a whole plethora of people, Baudin, the Russian political thought is miles away from then. And Russians under Ivan the Terrible were dealing with this question that you and I were just talking about just a minute ago, Aaron, which is, what do you do with a bad king? And I think our conversation has illustrated, at least I hope it has, that the Russians simply didn't have a good answer for that. They didn't know what to do with a bad king. They didn't want to kill him or replace him because there was no mechanism for doing that. They could try to persuade him through moral suasion that he should do things differently. But if in the end, like Ivan himself, he proved impervious to that, then there was nothing really to be done. But in addition to talking about political thought, I also talked about the kind of surviving sources that we have, which are remarkably sane. We don't have all the plethora of new genres that appeared in the late Middle Ages, and particularly in early modern Europe and in Western Europe. So you don't have, there's no Shakespeare, obviously. You don't have any genre of fiction. You don't have genres of autobiography, really. There's lots of things. There is an autobiography of an old believer named Avakum, but really the intellectual scene really is very, very unlike the scene in a Western European country. Now, it's not that there were no similarities at all, but I think if you're looking for a parallel, the most obvious parallel is with Carolingian Europe. When I was writing that essay, I had the chance to read a lot of Western European, sort of Carolingian history writing, and also Western scholarship about that writing. And it struck me as being much closer to what I was trying to say about political thought in early modern Russia in the time of Ivan the Terrible than if I were reading an essay about Machiavelli, for example, or Hobbes. I had the chance, and one of the resulting essay is in the book, to be part of a collaborative investigation of political thought in early modern Europe. And so I was involved in very lengthy discussions. We had four meetings in Europe where we all got together. They were scholars who were experts in political thought in Italy, in France, in England, in Poland, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, the Ottoman Empire. Really, it was a very wide selection of environment or of countries. And so I was talking about Muscovite political thought. And they pretty much agreed with me that it was really pretty different than what was going on in their fields. But I think then when you get to the question of military affairs or the administration of the law, you find also quite striking similarities. But I think what happens both in political thought, but particularly in administration, is that there's a pace of change which is very rapid. So if you start in 1500, you really have a very primitive apparatus that really is like, let's say, the apparatus of a Carolingian king. And by the time you get to the time of Peter the Great, you have a highly developed bureaucracy with very, very well articulated rules of procedure. You have a very great law code, really a belief in the rule of law. So what I was saying about Ivan the Terrible is certainly not true in the 17th century and is even less so in the 18th century.
Yeah, that's what I was curious about. I've always liked that essay, and I was wondering if you could talk about it a little bit.
It was fun to write, I have to say. It's the one essay that doesn't have any footnotes in it.
Yeah, I hope that someday I get to write one of those. You know.
Yeah. Well, Aaron, you should. You know, you have to give yourself permission to do that.
Yeah.
And And I gave myself permission, but I was imitating Ned Keenan, who, you know, that Russian Folkways article, which is so famous, that has, you know, essentially no footnotes either. So I thought, well, if he can do it, I can do it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nice. I think maybe once in your life, you ought to sit down and just say what's on your mind, you know? I thought maybe a good way of wrapping up our talk here might be that your book is kind of a unique occasion to look back and say, okay, what's different in, you know, the history or medieval and early modern Russian history now than it was 50 years ago? Like, are there big questions that you think historians have reached conclusions or, you know, some kind of broad consensus on? Are there ones that you think are still really kind of out there and are up in the air? Where's the field at now in 2022 in terms of the really big questions that have animated it over the course of your, you know, career here?
Well, Aaron, that's a kind of a $64,000 question. And the reason I wrote the final essay, the last essay in the book, the way I did, was that I didn't really want to answer it. That is to say, I didn't feel like I could sort of pontificate as to where the field was, or, you know, kind of give a summary answer for my own work, saying this is the truth and nothing else is the truth. But I think I did try to argue, and I think I argued with pretty good evidence, that the idea that basically early modern Russia was a kind of proto-dictatorship that was really ultra-authoritarian has been pretty largely discarded now by historians. I don't know any historians, either in the West or in Russia, really, who are prepared to defend that. And there are certainly historians in Russia who've in their own way questioned it in a really interesting way, with very close reading of documentary sources. And so I think when it comes to the law, when it comes to court structure, which Nancy Coleman has written about, the Valerie Kivelson's incredibly imaginative reconstructions of the mental worlds of various groups of people in Russia in that time, Russell Martin's investigations of royal weddings, which they seem like a trivial, you know, idea now. I mean, who cares about royal weddings? We've just seen how many people care about a royal funeral.
Funeral, yeah. Yeah, you beat me to it.
Anyway, it turns out the royal weddings were probably the most important event in the political life of the Muscovite court. And Russell has shown, again, how the boyar aristocracy was able to manipulate what appears to have been an exercise of pure monarchical power. So I think the field has really moved away from what I would say is an oversimplified view. But they haven't then said, well, Russia was a proto-democracy. The kind of sort of dreams and wishes of late 19th, early 20th century Russian historians are not where we've landed either. And I think we've landed in a place where we think that Russia probably was closer to contemporary Western Europe, especially in the 17th century, than has traditionally been thought. It's not a kind of a view of Russian exceptionalism, which I think is a really interesting word to use because it's been so important in American history. And it's used by Putin very much and by Russian national historians, that we have our own path and we have nothing to do with Western Europe. I think that that also is not really true. And that in each of these cases, in political culture or ideology that I've been writing about, in the court structure, in the law, in royal weddings, it's a kind of complicated give and take relationship between the ruler and chiefly the elite, but also reaching further down into society, certainly into more humble servitors, military servitors, and sometimes down into the peasantry. That it's not an all-powerful monarch. It's certainly not an all-powerful, citizenship. It's a kind of uneasy mixture in which people are just trying to get along and find a way to solve very particular problems. How do you administer the law? How do you run the court? How do you field an army? These are all pressing questions, and they just were worked out, but they could only be worked out if the ruler and his elite were collaborating together. And if they ceased that collaboration, and particularly if factions broke out of court, the situation could devolve very quickly to civil war and bloodshed.
Seems to me like Don Ostrowski just used the word symphony to describe that in his most recent. I actually just talked to him about that book not too long ago for the New Books Network as well. I think that was his phrase.
That's an old Byzantine phrase. And Dmitry Obolensky, whom I mentioned earlier, really makes a very good case for there being a concept of symphony in Byzantium. And I agree with Don. I think that's a really nice word to use. It was the aim. It was the wish for a symphony, but there was, there were occasionally, people playing out of tune.
Yeah, I was about to say, that's sometimes people be flat when they should have beat, So, well, thanks for taking an hour to talk to me about the book, Dan. That's enlightening as always. So thank you very much.
Aaron, it's a great pleasure. I remember our time when you were a graduate student with extreme fondness. And I love it. You're doing these interviews. Thank you for taking the time to interview me about this book. I'm really happy about the book. I felt a little bit reticent about my own work for much of the time, but it's gotten a very good reception. And as I hold it up and look at it, I'm kind of proud of it. So,
That's understandable. All right. Well, have a good rest of your day, Dan.
Thank you, Aaron. Be well.